It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you're here. A string of bank failures casts a shadow over the vitality of regional banks, and we wonder, how stable is Wisconsin's banking sector? Call in with questions about the financial industry and regulating banks and credit unions. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cheryl Olson-Collins is a secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, appointed by Governor Tony Evers in January 2022. Secretary designee Olson-Collins, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. I appreciate being here.
Well, so some of this timeline, of course, in March and now in this month, three California-based banks fail, one New York bank collapses. How vulnerable to failure are Wisconsin banks compared to these other banks?
Well, I don't know if you're referring to PacWest. PacWest has not closed just yet.
Okay.
They're rumored to possibly going to close, but they have not yet. What I could do is start out with a little bit about those, the First Republic, Signature Bank, and Silicon Valley, and just briefly talk about them, and then talk about why our banks are different and credit unions. So Silicon Valley Bank was very tech concentrated, So they had the tech companies, they had the investment firms, they had employees. So they were not, they were unique and not diversified. They were about $209 billion in assets. The majority of their deposits were uninsured. Signature Bank of New York was a little different, but had some very similar profiles, and they were, the root cause really was poor management. Signature Bank was a crypto bank starting out, and that can cause some issues right along. Yeah. Everybody has been reading a lot about crypto. And then First Republic, again, high level of uninsured depositors. They were, that was the second largest collapse in U.S. history. But with all these banks, all had a very significant asset growth in a very brief period of time. So that can be a warning sign that perhaps a bank's letting go of underwriting standards and may not have the necessary personnel or technological systems to measure the risk of those assets. Then secondly, the banks all had very significant increases in deposits in just a couple of years. The Federal Reserve's year-long rate hiking campaign aimed at taming inflation partly accelerated the banking crisis. And that's a little bit complicated, but basically the Fed raises interest rates by selling assets, mm-hmm. namely Treasury bills. And when it does so, the price of bonds tend to fall while yields rise. So Silicon Valley Bank ran into trouble because too many customer funds were locked into bonds, and they call it unrealized losses. They're unrealized because it's upside down, but they haven't had to take the loss. But it became a problem when their depositors, which were like mostly startups and tech companies, needed to withdraw more money as other sources of funding dried up. And so to meet their withdrawal request, Silicon Valley had to sell bonds at an almost $2 billion loss. So the other thing is, regulators were acknowledging the issues. They had recognized there were problems in these banks. They did not act quickly enough or forcefully enough in some instances. They tried to work with the banks, but it was too slow. So that's another thing.
And so I just want to pause there with the bonds. So as you say, when the Federal Reserve starts its interest rate hike programs last year, bond prices fell rapidly. And so you see a Silicon Valley Bank losing $1.8 billion from having to sell its treasury bonds at a discount. So, bonds are safe havens. They've always been said to be safe havens. Is that practice placing Wisconsin banks at risk?
Well, I will tell you, yes. In the sense that some banks, yes, did put money in bonds. Not a ton of banks in Wisconsin have put them in such long-term bonds.
Okay.
But yes, that's part of a natural, when you're looking at all of the different investment opportunities that you can have, yes, some people want to have treasuries and bonds. There was a lot of deposits that came into banks with COVID. And so there is a variety of investments. And there was the thought process that well, the Fed's never going to, you know, rates were so long, low for so long with the Federal Reserve. Yeah. And so it was foolish, yes, in a way, to think that that wasn't going to change. But then again, a lot of people did not think that there was going to be such a crash. And that goes to the next thing that was, I think, so instrumental in this was social media. The speed at the runs of the banks due to the impact of social media is just incalculable. It was amazing, and that's one of the reasons why Signature Bank was closed on Sunday night. They knew that on Monday morning the run was so fast because everything is digital now. And there was a concern, I will tell you, when I got the call, I'm on nationwide calls with our state counterparts, like there's one of me in every state. Got it on the weekend, and it's unusual. I don't generally have an emergency call, but I check my emails, got on the call, and think, okay, they're going to talk about a large bank that failed. Why is this such an emergency? Well, it affected Wisconsin. It affected Wisconsin because Silicon Valley Bank had tech companies and fintechs that had businesses in payroll companies in Wisconsin. And the fear was that they would not be able to meet payroll on Monday morning. That's a big deal.
That is a big deal.
Notice then, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I know a lot of people have criticized with the Treasury and the President and the FDIC for doing that emergency coverage. But it was a good thing because I think we would have had a much bigger issue had that not been addressed. Go ahead.
I'm just going to reintroduce you here for a moment as we talk about the banking system with Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions Secretary Designee Cheryl Olson Collins. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question about our financial institutions, 800-642-1234. I know this seems like a really simple question. As you said, you know, you got the call on the weekend. Since then, I mean, there's been some time here. Have you made any changes at your agency since these bank collapses?
Well, actually, we had been working prior to the collapses. We understood, along with our federal counterparts, that these could be issues with the investment portfolios and unrealized losses. And so we have been working prior to this and since in contacting our banks, looking what the level of uninsured deposits are, looking at what the investment portfolio looks like, and are in constant communication with them. But I will say our Wisconsin banks and credit unions are in good health. First of all, we are smaller. We are true community banks in this state. And so we do not have the high concentrations that were indicative of those failures, those failed banks. For an example, we might have an ag concentration in a rural bank, but they still have, it's not to the degree of what these banks had. There might be a commercial concentration. I look at Madison and I see how, you know, look at this. All you have to do is see all the commercial properties going up. We are almost an anomaly in Wisconsin in our commercial growth. It has very closely been watched and measured, and it's not to say that couldn't become problematic, but our institutions are very, very cognizant of managing that risk. And really, bank failures, I mean, the main responsibility for bank failures is laid at the feet of its directors and officers. And our management officers, directors in Wisconsin, they are very much in tune to what is going on. They're well capitalized. Examination results, of course, are confidential, but I will tell you that we are in very good state wise.
When you say that, like, is that pertaining to like a stress test, or explain what you mean there?
Well, yes. So we look at various things when we go in and do an examination, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a comprehensive look. It's not just one thing. But we look at the depth and frequency of stress testing depending upon the institution's size and complexity. And so the idea is for banks to measure their exposure to changing environments. That's what stress testing is.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of interest rate risk, The unprecedented rise in the interest rates over the last year has to be carefully measured and monitored by bank management. And we have done that. And we go in and we look at that. But we also look at other things in an exam. We look at cybersecurity. We look at, yes, capital, investments. We look, do you have risky investments? We don't tell a bank or credit union what they can have for investments. But if they do have a few risky investments in there, they better, you know, mitigate that risk with some safer investments. So there's a wide variety of things that we look at when we go in for an exam.
Cheryl Olson-Collins, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions, as we discuss regulating and monitoring state chartered banks, savings institutions, consumer financial services industries. Join the discussion. Call in with a question or your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the leader of the state agency in charge of safeguarding Wisconsin's financial institutions and increasing financial capability across the state. Call in with your questions, your thoughts at any time, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cheryl Olson-Collins is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. Let's turn to credit unions here. 100 years ago, looking at history, the first credit union in Wisconsin is established in Milwaukee. And today, credit unions represent 20% of the financial services market in our state. Do you see, from a regulatory perspective, are credit unions, these not-for-profit financial cooperatives, are they any different than banks?
Well, there are some differences between credit unions and banks, but I would say from a regulatory standpoint, banks and credit unions are very solid. We regulate for safety and soundness, and that's what we look at, and they are both very safe and sound. I think one of the main things is it's the Wisconsin ethic. I really do see there's a difference. We have smaller credit unions, smaller banks. We do have a couple, billion-dollar credit unions, billion-dollar banks, but by and large, they're small and community-oriented. And I think that that is the difference. They know their customers. They're in their communities, and they service them. But we are in good shape.
You mentioned small and community-oriented. Digging a little bit more deeply there. Last year, Summit Credit Union, based in Cottage Grove, acquired West Bend-based Commerce State Bank. It was said to be the largest credit union acquisition of a bank in state history. How big is too big when it comes to banks and credit unions?
Well, we have no danger of that happening in the state of Wisconsin compared to the other states in the nation, for sure. I do think some of these mega large banks it could cause problems. Simply, we've seen what happens when you get too big, when the growth is too fast. And if it's managed, it's okay. But I personally am very happy to regulate smaller community banks because I know they care about their communities, they care about their customers, and they know their customers, and they know what their communities need. So they're not going to do crazy stuff. And I think, is there a threshold I think is too big? No, I can't say that. If an institution is well-run and safe and sound, I guess I'm not going to criticize that. But I would say in Wisconsin, that's not the case. And even with further mergers, I don't see that becoming that big of an issue, at least in the foreseeable future.
And when you say crazy stuff, what might fall into that category?
I will say that there has been talk about some cryptocurrency, whether or not it's dabbling in that. There certainly are institutions, the few that have looked at that, are backing it by established assets. Because there's such a volatility in the value of cryptocurrency. It's just, and I think one of the things that we have seen, and we've watched a couple of banks that were experimenting in this. We watch it very carefully. There's been a great retraction, obviously, with all of the changes that have occurred in cryptocurrency, the volatility of the market. It's an investment. I'm not saying that the underlying, like the Bitcoin and all that type of thing, the underlying, I can't think of the word, how it is made or whatever, cryptocurrency, is the technology is fine. It's just that the volatility of it. And there's a lot of sketchy things, who is making the Bitcoin, this and that. So we've seen that actually being curtailed in our state because of the fact that people get nervous because there's such a loss. There's a commercial out there that, you know, the guy is on there and says, I'm a millionaire. And then he goes, I'm not a millionaire. I'm a billionaire. And that's really indicative of the volatility of the cryptocurrency because it goes up and down.
I hear you using the word volatility quite a bit here. And I mean, you've had in your history being involved in bank leadership. And if this is a teachable moment for banks to diversify their holdings, can banks quickly make big changes to their financial holdings? How hard is that?
Well, you know what? This is not, I would say, a teachable moment was more in 2008, to tell you the truth, in 7 and 8 with the crash. That was a credit quality crisis. And the banks learned from that, right? You really can see how things can go downhill and see the bigger picture. This is, I would say, a blip in the screen. This is not the current issues that are out there right now with the unrealized losses. That's not something that's totally new. It is could happen, and it's hard to pivot. But if those losses are unrealized until you have to use them, right? Mm-hmm. So if there's not a bank run, if you've managed well, you can ride this storm. And I do believe our Wisconsin banks and credit unions are in good situation with that. Can you pivot? Well, you can sell anything, but you can sell it at a loss, and that's the concern. Mm-hmm. If you don't need the money, you'll eventually get better in better shape. So I don't think this is not 2007, 2008. Okay. It really isn't.
All right, we're going to move on next topic with Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions Secretary Designee Cheryl Olson Collins. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Looking more closely at unbanked households, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is reporting the FDIC says the share of unbanked households in the Milwaukee area was 1.5% in 2021. That is down from 5.9% in 2019. What is causing more people to start banking?
I think there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I think that financial institutions, banks and credit unions, and CDFIs, which are community development financial institutions, are definitely more proactive. And our banks and credit unions are out in those communities. And they are trying to, you know, teach people to save, teach people to how to do a loan, how to do a mortgage. And I think there's been a great outreach. I think under Governor Evers, too, we've really amped up our outreach efforts. We do at the department financial literacy. We have a division dealing with financial literacy where we partner with employers, with, you know, other community groups. And we do have some, like I said, CDFI banks and credit unions that really focus on those unbanked. We have actually, which is I've participated in some banks and credit unions doing, but they actually take the kids in schools and they, you know, you go out and you have to buy a car. You have a scenario. You're given a scenario where you have a wife and two kids, and this is what your job is, and this is what your income is. Now go live life. And you go to different stations. It's absolutely eye-opening. But the kids are really getting involved, and I think that financial literacy is getting out there more than it ever has. So I think that really makes a difference.
Would you support it as part of the curriculum in state law?
Yes, I would say that prior to even that legislation, You know, you have there's funding issues, that type of thing. We have supported at DFI going out and talking to banks, or I'm sorry, to schools about getting financial literacy courses. And really, a lot of schools on their own have done that. But I do think it's absolutely integral to financial health and how well an individual can succeed in the future if they have this knowledge. It's the old knowledge is power. It's absolutely true.
Secretary-designee Olson Collins, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Cheryl Olson Collins, Secretary-designee of the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story for Mother's Day.
Many of us are grateful for everything our mothers taught us. For Jana Rose Schleiss, she's thankful that her mother taught her how to be beautiful.
I learned how to be a woman from my mom. What I mean is, I learned how to express my femininity from her. This isn't unique to me. For a lot of people, our mother is our first beauty standard. We grow up thinking she's the prettiest woman in the world. For girls, at some point in our lives, we gotta decide what kind of woman we wanna be and how we present that to the world. Through a million minuscule choices, we express ourselves and our femininity. The older I get, the more I realize I've been modeling myself off mom in subtle and not so subtle ways. My mother was a teacher. She also had five kids and a dairy farm to help run. When we were younger, she didn't have time for frivolous beauty trends or anything that wasn't practical. My three sisters and I, however, wanted everything new and impractical the early aughts could offer. Blue eyeshadow, the infamous Rachel haircut, and oh my gosh, flip-flops. When my mother goes out, her routine is this. Makeup, mascara, a bit of eyeliner, lipstick, hair. A few curls applied to her cropped locks, then brush back. Accessories. She keeps her most worn jewelry in a shot glass in the kitchen cupboard. I don't know how this became the norm. It drives my father, who bought much of it, crazy. She dumps the glass out, chooses a pair of small hooped earrings, and puts the many gold rings she wears on her hands. She's ready. I'm 30 now, and I've had plenty of time to experiment with my femininity. For style, there was the mismatch floral print phase, the crop tops and platforms phase, and this was all just during college. My hair journey has been similarly chaotic. For the few years I was a wannabe hippie, I didn't cut or even brush my hair. I could tell it drove my mother nuts, but she had a light, perhaps sometimes passive-aggressive touch. I'd receive gift cards for haircuts and the quick aside of, run a comb through your hair and then we'll go. But overall, she knew I needed to work through this stuff on my own. I've been dyeing my naturally brunette hair red for 10 years. This vibrant hair has become my brand, if you will. A friend recently asked why I chose this color. I told the story of how it initially happened. I got a horrid haircut before studying abroad. I bought a box of dye and tried to take control of the situation. To my 20-year-old self, this made sense. But looking back, it's obvious why red is the ideal beauty standard to me. For as long as I can remember, my mom's hair has been dyed shades of auburn. By the way she carries herself, my mother has taught me to never be ashamed of my body. She's always seemed so comfortable in hers. Something I'm very thankful for in a world that sends women messages like, you're too fat, you're too tall, you're too loud, you're too assertive, you're too independent, and the choices you've made are wrong. When I was younger, my mom let me be whatever I needed to be. All through puberty and the many confusing chapters after, I could always come to mom. She'd take me and my questions about my body and beauty seriously. I have nieces now, and I know they're watching, taking in the variety of women around them. They giggle at my armpit fuzz, want to touch my nose ring. They'll grow into their femininity one day too, play around with it and try different things. I'm so grateful they have many strong and beautiful women in their lives to take cues from. When I go out, my routine is this. Makeup. Mascara, brows, lipstick. Hair. A few curls, brush back. Accessories. From a jewelry box, I choose a variety of cheap gold rings and a pair of earrings. I know I'm ready. I know I'm beautiful because of Mom.
Jana Rose Schleiss brought us that story on her beautiful mother. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the nonprofit newsroom, Wisconsin Watch, investigating the supply chain of Milwaukee Tool. That's the Brookfield-based manufacturer for nearly a century, and finding its subcontractor was connected to prison labor in China. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Zhen Wang is an investigative journalism fellow at Wisconsin Watch, previously at The Guardian's Beijing Bureau and China Daily. Zhen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. You investigated how these work gloves for the Wisconsin company, Milwaukee Tool, they're made by prisoners in China. What products are Chinese prisoners making?
Right. So for this specific prison, which locates in central China, it amazed me that it makes all kinds of goods, including bags, shoes, work gloves, and prisoners said to me they're making gloves for Milwaukee Tool. That's part of the funding of the investigation.
How did you learn about this situation?
Yeah. So, well, it's a long story, but I'll keep it short. It came from a tip. The tip came into Wisconsin Watch that Milwaukee Tool was using for some prison labor in China to produce work gloves. But tackling the story was tricky because a person who knew what was happening in the prison was also the wife of a dissident imprisoned there. She is a recent immigrant living in the Twin City areas. And her name is called Shi Minglei. She feared for herself, her daughters, and also her husband behind bars halfway across the world. But the thing, at the beginning, she didn't trust me at all. Because I'm a Chinese and I'm also an intern for Wisconsin Watch. I needed first to prove to Shi that I was, not a spy and that she could trust me to tell her story. So, start reporting the story. I started building trust with her.
How did you do that?
Well, it's really complicated. I have to say it's quite challenging for me because I have to, I need to establish the prison manufacturing area, where that area is. And also, the big question for me as a reporter to ask myself is, were the allegations of forced prison labor in China is true, or to what extent it is true? I need to find out, how that prison factory connects with Milwaukee Tool. And then the idea of supply chain came in. Throughout the investigation, found one work glove supplier, which has been contracted to make gloves for the company.
You then had to, as you said, validate what you were hearing from someone in the Twin Cities, and you spoke with a human rights activist who mm-hmm. had been held at this prison in South Central China, And right. they told you that they had made gloves from Milwaukee Tool while in prison. What did you learn there?
Yeah, so I've learned that, you know, through their, I've talked to a former prisoners there. They not only describe me what the working conditions like in the prison and the scale of the manufacturing in that prison. And also they told me, you know, all kinds of details of their, in their production lines, you know, they cut fabrics and also they sewing pieces together and snitches labels onto every single pair of Milwaukee Tool gloves so that they find out, wow, this is, you know, Brookfield based company and prisoners that, oh, we're making gloves for American company. So that's, you know, all the details, you know, came from them.
So these people held in the prison, how many hours a day are they making these gloves? How much were they earning?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, the shocking part I found out is that, you know, one of the prisoners called Li Mingzhe, he told me that he pretty much worked 19 hours a weekly to produce the work gloves. And, you know, he was paid by pennies. If you count, you know, in American dollars in that way.
Did he have a choice?
Well, that's a part I've also find out because he's pretty much spent 5 years in the prison. At the beginning, he was making some other products. And all of a sudden, he said to me, just after the pandemic got started, he was dragged into this Milwaukee Tool work gloves production. So meaning that he didn't choose what to make at all. But of a sudden, you know, he made this involuntarily through this production of Milwaukee Tool gloves.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. Wisconsin Watch reporter Zheng Wang on the supply chain of Milwaukee Tool and how it sources its work gloves. Call in with a question, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a Wisconsin Watch investigation that traces the supply chain of Milwaukee Tool gloves to a prison in China. Brookfield-based Milwaukee Tool denies any wrongdoing, saying in a December statement that it doesn't tolerate the use of forced labor. Join the discussion. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Zheng Wang is a Wisconsin Watch investigative journalism fellow. Zheng, take us into how you verified the supply chain and how you connected the dots here. How did you verify what you heard about prisoners being forced to make gloves, work gloves for Milwaukee Tool?
Yeah, so, well, to be able to connect all the dots together, I spent lots of time in making the connections. So collected lots of evidence that verify the name of the subcontractor, which is, you know, I find out is one of the suppliers for Milwaukee Tool through prisoners, and also in regulatory fillings. I find another former inmate who could verify what Li Mingzhe's story, and through his narrative, which was nearly identical to Lise, both of them said they were subject to discipline, including beatings and banning family visitations when they failed to get the work done on time. And, you know, at this point, as you need to verify the specific suppliers to prisoners claimed. So I attempted to purchase gloves on China's version of Amazon by talking with third-party vendors. I confirmed two suppliers are making work gloves for Milwaukee 2. One of them is this one supplier called Shanghai Select Safety Products. And, you know, following the line, I made contact with a self-identified salesperson for the supplier who verified the company was a supplier for Milwaukee Tools gloves and was, and is still manufacturing the majority of work gloves for the company. So I think by doing this, I established the connections between the prisons and the subcontractors in China, and as well as Milwaukee Tool.
So you're, in a sense, you know, had to present yourself as a buyer, and you contact a salesperson for this company, Shanghai Select Safety Products, and that way you're able to further verify what the filings and the customs records had said?
Yes, correct. Because, you know, the two inmates were, they cannot verify or provide any evidence whether the supplier is still subcontracting by Milwaukee 2, you know, as of today. So, I mean, there is a gap that I need to verify.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, therefore, I you know, I was undercover and to be able to obtain that information.
How did it feel for you to go undercover?
You know, there's no way for me to obtain any public available information. No, I was, you know, trying to, I mean, that's a last resort. I would tend to, if I have other opportunities, I was, just asking, to verify if it is still a supplier for Milwaukee Tool and what kind of work gloves they're making for the company.
Is it legal for an American company to import products made by forced labor? What are the laws like?
Right. Well, so there's a federal law called Section 307 that basically prohibits the importation into the United States of any goods made wholly or in part using forced labor. Forced labor or prison labor in any foreign countries. So to the specific case of Milwaukee Tool, which is sourcing from a foreign prison, you know, according to human rights lawyers, they told me that that's a form of in violation of Section 307.
Are there penalties? What penalty could a company face for violating this part of the law?
Yeah, so before, you know, any penalties implemented, I have to say that when U.S. agencies, it's called the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, is responsible for implementing the law. The agency has the power to issue a detention order. I mean, if they find reasonable but not conclusive evidence, and then they will issue a detention order to prevent imports from entering the U.S. So having said that, but the CBP will do their own investigation to determine if such an order is necessary or needed. Or not. So if a company such as Milwaukee 2 is sourcing from a foreign prison, it violates federal law. And, you know, if the CBP issue a detention order after their own investigation, the company will likely to have financial, legal, and reputational consequences. for the company. Yeah.
Zhen Wang with us, investigative fellow with Wisconsin Watch, as we talk about the report saying Chinese prisoners were forced to manufacture work gloves for Milwaukee Tool. You can join in along the way. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. How is Milwaukee Tool responding to your reporting?
So, you know, when I presented all my findings to Milwaukee Tool, they said, you know, they have done their own investigation and find no evidence to support the allegations made by Shi Minglei, the woman who lives in the Twin Areas. I was, you know, I was not happy at all about their response, because they made no specific responses to my questions. And as of today, I haven't, you know, heard anything from them yet.
What questions are you hoping to explore further in the future?
That's a good question. So any actions, responses from the government agencies, from Shi Minglei, the petitioner, and also from Milwaukee too, I would like to do a follow-up in this regard.
A follow-up story.
Yes.
Zhen, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zhen Wang is an investigative fellow, journalism fellow with the nonprofit news organization Wisconsin Watch, previously worked for the Guardian Beijing Bureau and China Daily. We reached out to Milwaukee Tool for a response to the Wisconsin Watch investigation. In a statement, Milwaukee Tool says, "We have strict policies and procedures in place to ensure that no authorized Milwaukee Tool products are manufactured by using forced labor. Milwaukee Tool only partners with suppliers that similarly commit to ethical labor practices throughout their supply chains and who ensure that no forced labor is used. Milwaukee Tool regularly conducts a complete and thorough review of our global operations and supply chain. We have found no evidence to support the claims being made." I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.